Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. On this edition of Line One, we're going to discuss the newest information on allergic diseases with Anchorage allergist Dr. Jeff Demain. Dr. Demain is the founder and director of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska here in Anchorage. He's been deeply involved in education throughout the state and nationally. He's involved with many of the committees with the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and he's published and co-authored books. It's, fourth or fifth time Jeff's been with us. Nice to be back. Have you back?
Well, I'd love to be back. Thanks for the invitation again.
So what we hope to do today is a couple of things. I would like the listeners to gain a little bit better basic understanding of asthma, allergy, and eczema. And then quickly, we want to kind of learn some of the new developments in this field. I was thinking on my way here today that perhaps no other field of medicine that I'm aware of in the last couple of years has made so many important changes, other than perhaps oncology, where we're seeing some finally the fruits of all the research, and particularly immunology, beginning to pay some benefits in the treatment of cancers. Anyway, the information today we hope will include a range of topics from very simple, inexpensive suggestions to perhaps prevent eczema from ever getting going in the first place, and to the newest kind of biologic immunotherapy being used to treat things like severe asthma and really resistant atopic dermatitis. You can reach us if you have questions or comments the following ways. If you live in Anchorage or you're at least sitting here in Anchorage, you can call us 550-8433, 550-8433, a toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, Jeff, let's start with the basics. How do you define allergy? And then give me some examples of allergy.
Well, allergy is, like you said, a very broad topic. And just to lay the groundwork, it is an immunologic disorder. So all of the things we're talking about are really founded and grounded in immunologic issues. So we think about allergy and we separate it from sensitivity. So sensitivity is somebody that may make an antibody, say, against a cat, as a good example. Well, but they may have a cat and do just fine when they're around it, so they don't have any clinical symptoms. So that person would be sensitized but not allergic. So being allergic means you have true clinical disorder in association with that exposure, whether that exposure be something in the air, like a cat, a food that you're eating, a medication that you're taking, or it also can be chemicals that you're exposed to, whether at work or something you're putting on your skin.
So it's our own immune system, which is designed to protect us from foreign proteins in general, has gone amiss.
That is correct. And there's a lot of ways it can go amiss. It is an extraordinarily complex milieu, and there's been just a tremendous amount of efforts to understand where these mistakes can occur in the immune system. And that understanding has led to the therapies in treating malignancy, in treating severe asthma, in treating patients with rheumatoid arthritis or psoriasis. It's that understanding of why this happens. And then you focus the therapies, the biologic therapies, on trying to remedy those errors.
Yeah. Block some response or improve one response or correct something that's not genetically there. So
all the above.
All right, so it's allergy is a reaction to a foreign protein. Now, what I see often gets confused in the public is autoimmune disease and allergy. So I think of autoimmune as a reaction to self proteins, not foreign proteins. So is that enough of a description to make it work?
Yep, exactly right. So you're having a heightened immune response, like you said, to self. And where allergy is a heightened immune response or an aberrant response to something that's usually external, extrinsic, like a food or an airborne allergen.
Neither one are normal, and the consequences of making a reaction to yourself or to a foreign protein can cause allergy or autoimmune disease.
Yes.
So the common example I want to say is everybody says, well, I have celiac disease, whether they do or not, it's another issue, but that's I have this allergic disease, celiac disease. So that's not an allergy.
No, but it is immune.
Okay.
So we think of allergy as being related to an antibody called IgE, as in like echo E. And so that is allergic, whereas celiac disease seems to be associated more with IgA, alpha. Okay. And actually, there's some very interesting paper published in the last few months has really even ferreted celiac disease down even further as to understanding. So not only is it related to an IgA antibody, what happens is there's a defect in what we call tissue transglutaminase. Tissue transglutaminase deaminases gluten. And if you can't deaminase gluten, you can't tolerate gluten, and you're going to trigger that immune response. Mm-hmm. Most IgA actually sits on the surface of the mucosa. So it's in the gut. It's in the blood as well, but it's on the surface of the gut, and that's when that reaction occurs. But what's really interesting is what's recently been identified is there's actually a defect in what we call a T regulatory cell. And there's a big long name for that cell, called a forkhead box 3 T regulatory cell. But there's a defect in that regulatory cell, which is really important. That regulatory cell is what induces what we call immune tolerance. So you can become immune tolerant, meaning it goes away. Mm-hmm. But it does that through the cell, or that T regulatory cell. Mm-hmm. And a lot of therapies now are really trying to focus on that.
Yeah, and we probably will get to this term tolerance a little bit later, hopefully when we talk about food allergies, because now others are beginning to help us develop tolerance to food proteins, yep. Which is a big advance.
Yes, it is. Let me talk about it now.
Hang on just
All
a
right.
second.
I'm getting excited.
I want to come back. I want to make sure people hear this difference between sensitization and allergy. So allergy is disease. Sensitization is you've got a potential immune response that may or may not work. And you gave an example. Another example I think of is you skin test somebody and they're positive for ragweed and they're living in Alaska and they may have symptoms. But the problem with that is we don't have ragweed.
Exactly.
So, you know, there are various ways you might be sensitized but not have symptoms. And it's not enough, given this line of understanding, to just say you have a positive test or sensitization. You need to talk with somebody. You need to have some real clear evidence to increase the incrimination that your symptoms are related to that positive test that says you're sensitized.
Correct. And there's different reasons that people don't react. And that's because they have normal mechanisms, normal immune mechanisms mm-hmm. that protect them from it. They have what we call blocking antibodies would be one example. So their immune system is already taking care of the problem. So they're sensitized, but nothing ever happens as a result of it because their immune system worked properly. And part of that, at least a significant part of that, is genetic. Some people are predisposed, meaning they're in their genetics give them more likelihood of developing allergy, just like genetics give them more likelihood of celiac disease we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Like if you have the genetics, what we call a DQ2, DQ8, you have a higher probability of celiac disease. But 40% of the normal population has one or both of those genetic alleles. So it doesn't mean 40% have celiac disease, only 1% do. So as long as there's other mechanisms in place to prevent the sensitization to becoming disease, you know, that's really the key.
There's another kind of general comment there that I think is fair to say. The genetics does not necessarily predict the outcome. There are situations, Huntington's disease is one, mm-hmm. but in general, it's the genetic risk that you inherit plus unknown factors often described as environmental issues that lead to the manifestation of problems and why there can be so much variability. And which gets into some significant ethical issues with testing and so forth, which we don't need to get into.
Right.
Anyway, before I turn you loose on all these new diseases that you're chomping at the bit to do, let's answer the question, or no, we're not going to answer the question. Let's try to suggest some answers to the questions why we are, in most Western societies and societies that become more rich, suddenly notice they start having more allergy.
Well, that is a big question. And there's been an amazing amount of work done with that. Some of the early work that you're very familiar with that, in fact, you did quite a bit of work with it, is the hygiene hypothesis. So that means living in a more sterile world, you're less exposed to many of the organisms that may actually protect us. You're more likely to develop allergy. That's been shown to make the distinction between people living on a farm with livestock have a 50% less chance of developing allergy than somebody that lives in an urban environment. So they have very different food sources. And it really comes down to probably being exposed to the bacteria that they pick up from the animals. So studies have actually shown growing up, you know, through the first year of life with a dog or a cat in the home may decrease the likelihood of developing allergy for the same reason. We refer to that as lipopolysaccharide. But what you just mentioned, in a big global sense, we realize it's not just the bacteria exposure, and that gets in. Then we get into what we call the microbiome, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, but we call it the epibiome. So the epibiome is not just the bacteria in your intestine and lungs and skin, not just the organisms we're exposed to in our home, but it gets into, do your parents smoke? It gets into, what is your diet like? You know, is it balanced? Do you get sun? Are you exercising? So that epibiome really takes into account everything that you do, including your work and playtime.
And it just dawned on me while we were talking that this whole idea of the environment interacting with our genes, one, makes all the sense in the world. That's how animals adapt to their environment, so to speak.
Yep.
But this whole idea of the hygiene hypothesis gets back to the idea that these environmental influences, and what you just said, it's not one, it's not two, it's multitude of interacting with a multitude of different genes that are also interacting with each other that makes this extremely complex. But as we're going to discuss, as we delve into this immunology and how the immune system is interacting with the genes and so forth, we're discovering mechanisms to address these diseases we call allergy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, you know, to take that just a tad bit further, when we talk about these exposures in the environment, we do want to bring in the exposures within, that mm-hmm. really the bacteria in different parts of our body, particularly mm-hmm. the colon, play a very significant role in who we are. And another thing in Western, as far as the immune system, another part of Western society is honestly exposure to antibiotics early in life. Exposure to antibiotics are going to significantly decrease the likelihood that you're going to go through life without allergy. Antibiotics are going to increase that probability because it changes that bacteria. Babies that are born by cesarean section have a higher risk of allergic disorders than babies that are born vaginally, again, because of the exposure to the normal bacteria of mom. So that baby born by C-section is going to have a different colonization in their gut of bacteria than the baby born naturally. And in Western society, 35-40% of babies are born by cesarean section.
So a corollary of what we've been saying about the environmental impact on genetics is that, like the brain in a baby, which is you get an 80% of your adult head size in the first 2 to 3 years, it's tremendously important. Our immune system is getting trained in that first couple of weeks or months, and maybe even in utero, so that it may be that the most important time of these genetic environmental interactions, as far as whether or not we are going to have manifestations of allergy, may be very early in life.
100%. You're right. Yeah, yeah. Within the first year of life, yeah, is really what we see.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about modifying gut bacteria with probiotics, for example, and that may be an interesting thing to delve into. You can modify the gut flora probably within the first few months or maybe even the first year of life. But beyond that, you're not going to do it. Not at least in a simple manner. It would be a much more complex approach to try to change what has become a normal cluster of bacteria.
Kiddo. We have a couple of phone calls coming in, and I want to go ahead and try to take at least one of those. Brenda, you're on line one.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if a woman eats an overabundance of a food or a substance, would that cause her baby to become allergic to that? And I'll listen to the answer over the radio. Thanks.
All right.
For taking my call. Bye.
Thanks for your call.
Hi, Brenda. That was an excellent question. And, you know, if we were before 2007, I might be telling you, yes, that may increase the likelihood of allergy. But after around 2007, some of the information in literature and science that Dr. Woodard and I mentioned has actually shown that early exposure to foods seems to decrease that likelihood. So I would say there's still work to be done to understand it better, but it does appear that the earlier the introduction of that food protein, the more likely that your baby is going to develop an immune tolerance to that food. It's when foods are introduced later that may increase the likelihood of allergy. But that was a great question.
Okay. We got one more. Paul, you're on line one.
Hi, this is kind of gross, but you know, you mentioned you know C-section babies and their increased likelihood of allergies. How crazy of an idea is it to even give the baby maybe some material? I don't know how to say this material from the placenta or from the mother's. Body,
right,
and introduce
right,
it to the
right,
child, you know, right there at birth.
Right. So the idea is why not increase the amount of exposure to mom or the placenta to prevent allergy?
For C-section. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, for a baby who was born by C-section to try to get.
Yeah.
Oh, I
yeah.
got you. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a really good question, and that has been addressed. And as far as presenting to the placenta, not so much, but as far as baby exposure to the vaginal tract, there might be some benefit there. But what has been done is two things. One is to immediately put the baby on mom's breast, because the microbiome is not just in the gut, it's also on the skin and the respiratory tract. So there was a time when babies were born by C-section, they're immediately wiped off and cleaned off, taken to a hood, warmed up, evaluated, and there was this window of time before the baby was given to the mom. I think now, again, that's not my field, but I believe now the baby is born and immediately placed on the mom, and that's to really convey exactly what you're talking about. So good question. So I think you're absolutely correct. Maybe there is a time that enough research is going to support maybe exposing the baby to some of, you know, mom's vaginal flora.
All right. So, again, we want to be careful here that everybody's thinking reasonably. What we've said is that there's significant evidence that a decrease in certain exposures early in life may increase the risk of allergy and actually autoimmune illness as well. But you got to be careful that we don't go back to the fact where in 1900, four or five out of every 10 kids that were born didn't make it through the first year because they got infected and sick. And so you got to test these ideas for safety as well as efficacy as we try to learn how to balance that early exposure. Reasonable to give that warning?
I agree.
Okay.
But like I said, we just need science.
Yeah.
We need to make sure, first thing, is it safe? Secondly, is it effective? But I think the principle is good.
One thing we have not touched on, I think I would like us to, is these tests that we do, what you allergists do. How do they tell us? Obviously, we've talked about it. We test the sensitization with the test. Give us examples of a couple of tests and what they tell you.
Well, if you're looking at is somebody allergic, We can do that one of two ways. One is we can do or sensitized. We can do a skin test, which is the easiest, least expensive, and you get immediate answers. And what you're doing is you're seeing if there's an antibody, the IgE antibody that's specifically made for cat, for example, is bound to a cell in the skin called a mast cell. The mast cell is what releases chemicals that cause symptoms. So you place a small amount of a specific antibody or antigen, FLD1, FLD2. It's placed on the skin, and then if that mast cell has the IgE on it, it's going to react like a little mosquito bite. When you do a blood test, you're measuring that same antibody, but you're measuring the antibody circulating in the blood, not bound to the mast cell. Now, it's kind of important to understand that when the body makes an antibody, like IgE or IgG against infection, that antibody that it just made, we're using cat as an example, that antibody will only react to cat. Once that antibody is made, it is cat. Nothing else is going to react to that antibody. So if it's bound to the surface of the mast cell, it will only react to cat. So it's not. So that's important to know. So those are two tests. Again, they define sensitivity, and then you're correlating that with clinical evidence. You know, you can do challenges. You can challenge someone to cat by an environmental chamber. Or the most important, I think, is just making the history. So we take the history first, so we have a suspicion, and the test is used to support our suspicion. With food allergy, the correlation may not be as strong. You have a higher likelihood of having a sensitivity, but not a clinical association. So if you look at a baby or a child with eczema, for example, there's a high correlation with environmental and food allergy sensitivity. So we do the test, we identify which foods. Our first step is to say, okay, you have these three foods positive, remove those three foods, let the child get better, and then we spend a pretty significant amount of time trying to put that food back in. So then we do what we call controlled food challenges to determine, is this a true allergy or is it a sensitization? But that can only be done by a clinical method. To make that distinction. But the first step is having the suspicion. And, you know, again, once we evaluate the patient, you know, we're trained to recognize, is there a sensitivity / allergy in this patient?
I think this is a critical issue. So I want to harp on that or discuss that a little bit more. So it is insufficient in for most people, especially with foods, to restrict their diets for too much and too long. That is the treatment if they're sensitized to foods without going further to determine whether those foods you're sensitized to really are causing the problem you're trying to avoid.
Absolutely. And one of the big concerns, I'm be honest, this is a huge concern, is they're now marketing this broad food panel.
Right.
You know, you can walk up, never seen anyone, never talked to anyone. There's no history at all that suggests food allergy. You're going to get this blood panel, and it's going to show you're allergic to 12 foods. Mm-hmm. It has absolutely zero value. In fact, it's less than zero because it creates problems. It creates problems because suddenly the foods are being avoided that don't need to be avoided. Most typically, if we're looking at foods, we have a suspicion of these are one of these four foods is the problem, and we're focusing on those one or four foods. We're not focusing on 40 foods because you're going to have, you know, the chances of some sensitivity without allergy is there, and we want to try to minimize that the best we can. And then again, we move forward beyond that to prove that that is the offending food by challenges.
Not to belabor this too much, but I think you're also implying that these tests that are done for multiple foods, which most of the time come back with 15, 20 positives, not only is that uncommon in true allergy, these tests are often not IgE tests, they're IgG, which is, my understanding is, a normal immune response to food.
Yes.
That's why you get so many positives.
Yes.
And so that leads to people being told they can't eat 15 or 20 foods, which may not be very healthy and may not even help their problem.
Completely agree. Now, there's actually two. They're doing the IgE test out there now randomly as well.
Okay.
That, you know, you can walk up at a health fair and get a blood test for 20 foods, and it's meaningless. But even less meaning is, like you said, the IgG test. That's looking at what we call IgG subclass 4, which is 100% normal immune response. If I walk through the mall and I tested 100 kids at the mall, their moms would be mad, number one. But other than that, and I looked at IgG 4, 100% of those 100 are going to have positivity because it's normal. That is one of our protective mechanisms. I would be concerned with the one that didn't have it. If they didn't have a positive, I'd worry about immune deficiency, which is good for another show. We'll talk about immune deficiency later.
All right, Jeff, we've kind of, the basics, that's what I wanted to get across. I haven't opened the phone up too much, but we've asked for a couple, had a couple calls. So I think this is a good place to take a break. Then we're going to come back and really delve into asthma, allergies, food allergies, eczema a little bit more with some new developments, and particularly with treatments as well as some diagnostic things. So let me remind listeners, right now you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue this discussion on allergic disease with Anchorage allergist Dr. Jeff Demain. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Okay, we're back. Try to keep Jeff quiet during this period of time. Guy gets excited. All right, welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, and we're coming to you from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. As I said, with me today is Anchorage allergist and immunologist Dr. Jeff Demain, and we're discussing some basic information about allergies, allergic diseases, which are very important for people to understand. And we're going to move on to some new developments in asthma, allergic rhinitis, allergic eczema, and food allergies. You can email questions during the next 30 minutes. I'm going to be a little jealous about the number of calls I'm going to take, but you can go ahead and do it. I think it's important that we get some important information out, and I don't want to get bogged down too much, but I also have an obligation to answer your questions. So don't hesitate to call or email. Our local number is 550-8433, line1@alaskapublic.org, and again is our email address. And we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the last warning, if between 8 and 9 you're listening to this program, we will not be able to help you because you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. First off, is all asthma, is all eczema, is all rhinitis due to allergy?
Absolutely not. You know, I've in my career in medicine, we've had periods of time where we lump and we put everything together in one box, and then we split. Well, we're in a time of just mega splitting. So we look at what we call endotypes and phenotypes, which means we look at asthma and we can tease it out to 10 different kinds of asthma. We look at rhinitis, and you can have allergic rhinitis, which is sort of what we've talked about a bit, but then you can have simple non-allergic rhinitis, and there's a list of those different causes. Vasomotor rhinitis is a common one related to exposure to fragrances and fumes and smoke and temperature, but you can have sensitivity to other things as well. You can have nasal polyposis, chronic sinusitis, but all of these different types of conditions are treated differently. That's why it's so important for us to tease it out, identify exactly what subset of a condition is there, and then we treat it very specifically. The term for that is personalized medicine. And I think that we have really come a long way just in the last 5 years in really recognizing these different subsets of disorders and, you know, allowing us to treat them better.
All right. Let's talk about some new developments in food allergy as the broad-based topic for the next couple of minutes. And I don't know how many people out there realize that there are some new recommendations about feeding infants that are being shown, at least for sure, to decrease the development of peanut allergy. So I'm choosing my words carefully. Yep. But
there, first of all, we still recommend at least the first 6 months of life to be breastfed. I mean, I think that's still critical, and we should put that out first. And that does truly make a difference in many facets of the baby's life. But there was a beautiful study done by Gideon Lack in Australia. He recognized that children, Jewish children in Israel, had almost no incidence of peanut allergy. Yet Jewish children in Europe had 3 to 4% of them had peanut allergy. So looking at that, he said, well, what's the difference? Well, in Israel, they eat a little cracker, like a, it's a Zweibach-looking cracker, but it's peanut called Bamba. Well, they did a study. So they took children that had eczema or egg allergy. They did testing, identified sensitivity, challenged the babies to see do they have peanut sensitivity. If they just had sensitivity but no allergy, they were from 4 to 11 months of age, they were put on peanut. And the babies that, you know, they had another group that they didn't put on peanut. And the ones that had true peanut allergy, of course, they avoided peanut. Well, what they found is over time, they looked at different periods at 1, 2, and 3 years, what's the likelihood of developing peanut allergy? Well, the ones that were exposed to peanut, their likelihood of developing peanut allergy was 85% less likely than in the babies that did not have exposure. And then they followed this up with what we call a leap-on study, where does that immune tolerance continue after, you know, they stopped the study? And 2 years after the study was discontinued, it showed indeed they continued with immune tolerance, in other words, didn't develop peanut allergy. So that's really made a change in how the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology looks at feeding a baby. So they want early exposure, which goes back to Brenda's question where, you know, will overexposure cause an allergy? So at this point, we think no. We think that exposure is good. And so early introduction, there was a time where it was recommended that babies not have peanut until they were two. You know, just like egg, not until they're two. Well, now we recommend they get it early. So that is a very important new finding.
You want to be a little careful on this, and you probably best to deal with a pediatrician or an allergist when you start talking about introducing these things early. I mean, it can also be dangerous, although done correctly, it seems to be very safe and very effective.
Now, all these babies were tested. They were not just given.
Right.
And especially if you have a child that has eczema, the likelihood of peanut allergy is quite a bit higher. So there are certain babies that have a higher risk. So if you have a family history of allergy, you have a baby with eczema, you should talk with your pediatrician or your allergist.
Another thing that's happened in the food allergy realm is that there's becoming more and more, what's the word, accepted, validated, that oral immunotherapy to foods. Again, you got to know what you're doing here. This can be very dangerous. Is an effective way to develop tolerance.
That's true. And the studies have been done in Spain, in U.S., in Europe, and looking at how can we desensitize or induce immune tolerance to foods such as peanut, egg, milk, for example. Well, this is 7 years worth of data that is now coming in where, number one, there's going to be a vaccine for peanut allergy. That we kind of expected it this year, but there was some issues, so it's delayed. There's also a patch where maybe we can desensitize through the skin in studies being done in Spain, also not yet available. And what is available is what we call, what Thad mentioned, is oral immunotherapy. And this is very, very, very calculated, very closely measured and closely monitored. But these are true peanut allergic children that have been proven with challenge. And we start with very small amounts. And then this is gradually increased every 2 weeks, stepped up over a period of several months. So eventually, the child is literally eating 8 peanuts 3 times a week. That's their going to be the ultimate treatment. But this is, 8 or 10 months down the road. So what does this do? What it does is it takes away that terrible risk of severe anaphylaxis. That's the goal. There's a development of a level of tolerance. So if there is an accidental exposure, the risk is very low that something terrible would happen. That's also being done with egg and being done with milk. It's not been, quote, FDA approved, so it is, but there's certainly ample literature, especially literature out of Europe.
All right. We have a caller that has a question about eosinophilic esophagitis, and so I would like to see if I can, since we have so many callers and emails now, see if I can get that question answered a little bit. So this eosinophilic esophagitis is a finding that's become a little bit more prevalent in the last 10 years, and it relates to people who have heartburn, reflux, that may be allergic. So tell us about eosinophilic esophagitis, how it differs from maybe normal reflux.
Right. Well, eosinophilic esophagitis is what we refer to as a mixed immune response. So most immune disorders are a single type of immune dysregulation. In this case, it's mixed. It has a cellular inflammation, which is what we call a type 4 response, and it also has an IgE sensitization, which is what we call a type 1 response. So the food is eaten, it acts more like, what would it feel like to eat poison ivy? So it's not triggering an anaphylactic event or a severe allergic reaction, but it's triggering swelling, inflammation, ulcerative changes. They can get strictures. When you have in a child, it's having this abdominal pain, babies will arch and cry, especially after meals. And, very often milk is a culprit in a baby, is the most common culprit. But you take that food away, the inflammation resolves, and there's a 95% chance we can get that food back into the diet within 2 years. Mm-hmm. So in these patients, the reflux-like symptoms, they're not burping so much, but the abdominal pain is not responsive to medicines like antacids and medicines like Prilosec. In adults, we see it differently. In adults, they get food impaction. The food actually gets stuck. And that's a classic. In fact, if someone has food impaction, 55% chance it's eosinophilic esophagitis. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in adults, there is food association, but maybe not as responsive to dietary changes as with children and infants. With children and infants, they're almost completely responsive to dietary changes.
I didn't realize they weren't as responsive. I was going to say this could be a cure for a lot of adults, but that's taking it too far.
But it can. No, mm-hmm. You look, and you can have that eosinophilic inflammation, not just in the esophagus. Mm-hmm. We call it eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorder. So mm-hmm. It can be eosinophilic esophagitis, eosinophilic gastroenteritis, or eosinophilic proctocolitis. Eosinophilic proctocolitis is a baby that has bloody stools. So it's almost always mm-hmm. eosinophilic proctocolitis. Identify the food, take it away, it goes away.
Yeah, very surprisingly common thing now that we recognize it.
It is.
All right, I was going to move on. We got several phone calls, and I really hate to not address those, but I want to move through at least atopic dermatitis, eczema, and asthma with some new developments before we do much more. So one of the things that caught my attention is preventing atopic dermatitis, perhaps with better skin care early mm-hmm. in life. Is that in your mind, ready for prime time? Is there enough evidence? Is it going to work? And what are we talking about?
Well, atopic dermatitis, again, to get down to the genetics, is a deep mutation in what we refer to as filaggrin. So it is a genetic disorder. So that is going to affect the barrier of the skin. So when the barrier of the skin is disrupted, exposure to antigens the wrong way can occur. In fact, we feel that that's a common way that children can develop food allergy is through a disrupted skin barrier. So one of the things that I think you're mentioning, Thad, is there was studies looking at infants that are born and basically covering them with an emollient. It could be as simple as Vaseline or it can be something like CeraVe, but this emollient is placed on the skin. So it reestablishes that barrier. It holds the moisture in. So studies have actually shown, number one, less likely to develop food allergy, and two, these children do better. They don't get all these infections because that disrupted barrier also makes them more prone to fungal and bacterial infections.
Yeah. Very inexpensive. Not too hard to see this coming in a lot of kids. By a couple of months of age, they begin to get a kind of an extensor dryness before they really get some redness and itching and inflammation. And the whole idea is to prevent that inflammation and to not forget that our skin is like our intestinal tract and our respiratory tract. It's a source of a way that foreign proteins can enter our body. And so if we can keep that barrier under good control and not have eczema, we might it appears we can significantly affect the onset of some allergic disease.
Right. And water, there's also kind of a misinformation that you shouldn't bathe. Well, you should.
Right.
You don't need soap, but water is excellent. And what we do recommend is every day in water, just bathing in water. And when the child comes out of water, just lightly pat dry and then put on the emollient. We recommend trying to avoid emollients or creams that have fragrances and that have lanolin, because lanolin is the most common contact sensitivity that we see in children. So if it contains lanolin, don't use it. So again, simple things. Vaseline, CeraVe is probably one of our preferred. Vani cream, Elta cream are all very, very good.
You may have said it as I was distracted. The general rule is avoid preservatives and fragrances. Lotions are not as good as creams. Creams aren't as good as ointments and oils.
Right.
It's kind of the mantra at our office.
Right, yeah. Because
soak and trap.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, the lotions have alcohol, so that's going to be drying.
Mm-hmm.
And we also want to avoid products that contain food. You know, again, I said that's a good way that a child could develop food allergy. So if it contains soy, if it contains wheat germ, if it contains peanut oils or coconut oils, we generally steer away from using those types of products, or oats is another one. So you don't need to rub food on the skin. You know, that's going to be a key. Just simple, basic.
All right. Before we leave atopic dermatitis, what else you want to talk about? You want to get into some biologics or new medications?
Oh, yes. Of course I do.
All right.
I'm all about biologics.
Let's do it.
Well, there's been a lot of work looking at treating eczema. So in some countries, eczema is as high as 25% of the population. I mean, it can be really profound. And it can carry into adulthood. Up to 10% of adults have eczema. Now, this can be really problematic. It itches. They can't sleep, it breaks, it bleeds, it crusts, especially when it's on visible areas like the neck, the face, the hands. It can cause significant social disruption as well. So, but once someone has reached that point, they have so many changes in their skin. They're scratched, excoriated, thickened, lichenified, we call it, that aggressive management has been very ineffective, really. So there's a new therapy, it's called dupilumab or Dupixent, and it blocks what we call an interleukin-4 alpha receptor, which it blocks the production of the two of the most common cytokines that turn on the allergic reaction, IL-4 and IL-13. is really dramatic.
So these cytokines are internal messages in the immune system that's saying, hey, let's upregulate this inflammation, and we're going to block those with this new biologic.
Exactly. Okay. So you're stopping the reaction before it occurs is what you're doing. Very upstream, exactly. So these are messages that turn on all the bad things below. And the dupilumab or Dupixent, 45 to 50% within a few weeks, it's completely resolved.
Wow.
And, you know, when you're looking at 85-90% that have significant resolution or complete resolution, and these are patients that have really suffered with this, you know, most of their lifetime. So it really is a very exciting therapy. It's not approved in children yet. It's approved 18 and up. And it's relatively new. It was approved in March, so we have a fairly limited exposure to it. But, you know, the experience that we've had has been really tremendous. And it's very safe. And this is something that people can do at home. Hmm. So this is an injection they do at home every 2 weeks.
So what we want people to hear who have recalcitrant, difficult to treat, been frustrated, nobody seems to help them, kind of eczema that's involved affecting their life on a daily basis, it's a reason to sit down with the allergist and see if you're a candidate for this
right.
newer treatment, which seems to be safe and effective.
Right. It's very safe.
Okay.
And there are new topical medications that move away from steroids, some that have been around for a while called calcineurin inhibitors, such as tacrolimus and pricolimus, also go by the name of Protopic and blanking on their name, Elidil. But these turn off inflammation as well, and we get good success with them, and it's a topical therapy. A new one is called Eucrisa, and that also turns off inflammation by inhibiting what's called phosphodiesterase C2. Sometimes light box therapy, phototherapy can be helpful. So there's really a lot of opportunity beyond creams and steroids for managing bad eczema.
Asthma. All right, I'm going to leave this one to you. Will you tell me what you want to talk about with asthma?
Okay. Well, asthma, again, I want to first go by saying that asthma is very significant. It has a significant amount of morbidity and mortality. So people die from asthma, and they have very significant impact on their quality of life. Our focus on management of asthma has really been using inhaled steroids, inhaled medications to open airways up. And that's really been the cornerstone of our therapy, and then trying to identify the triggers, such as allergens, and taking that away as much as we can. But there are those that don't respond as well. And we've been very successful now in breaking out asthma into different subsets. And with those different subsets, we've been able to identify biologic agents for the moderate to severe asthmatic that's poorly controlled. And these agents have really changed people's lives. The first one that became available is called omalizumab or Xolair. It's been out now for about 10 years. And has, you know, truly changed lives. And many patients, they have, tremendous improvement in their pulmonary function. They don't need the oral steroids any longer, no ER visits, no hospitalizations. But this is an infusion, and they have to do this infusion in their doctor's office. They can't do it at home. And these biologics are really quite expensive, and that's one of the downsides. But they're relatively safe, although the patients need to be monitored. It doesn't mean that the asthma is completely cured, but it does improve significantly, and we can certainly wean back several of the medications. We also have seen the development of medicines that will treat or address the eosinophils. We mentioned that earlier, but eosinophils are white blood cells that are very, very inflammatory, and that is the cornerstone of the inflammation of about 80% of asthmatics. So we block what we call interleukin 5, and interleukin 5 downstream turns off that inflammation from eosinophils. So there's three products now that work specifically on blocking interleukin 5. One is called Nucala, another one is called Syncare, and mepolizumab is the generic name. And again, one is IV, the other one is a sub-Q injection. And we get good response from those. But these are people that have primarily eosinophilic asthma. There's another agent that is relatively new, and that's called Fasenra. Fasenra is benralizumab, and benralizumab is a little different. Rather than blocking the production of interleukin-5, it blocks a receptor called an interleukin-5 alpha receptor. Now, the difference is it's not decreasing eosinophils in the blood. It's actually going into the tissue, and it's causing the eosinophils to die. So it's removing the inflammation at the tissue level. And we're very excited about that because, again, the moderate to severe asthmatics that have not responded well to other therapies, we're very hopeful that this is going to make really be a step up. So I think this may be one of the maybe more effective biologic agents. Again, it's relatively new, and you know we certainly have put patients on it, and you know we're really hopeful we're going to see significant benefit in our patients, but the literature looks excellent.
One of the things that I've noticed, and maybe people that are listening, is a lot of these names of these newer immunologics are very difficult to say and pronounce. But they have a characteristic. They end in UMAB.
Right.
What in the hell is that all about? What does that mean?
Well, when you, you're exactly right. The first few letters are more proprietary, but the last letters tell you, is this chimeric, or meaning is it mouse and human, or is it completely humanized? If you have a U, that is what we call humanized. So you're not getting mouse protein in your body. Mm-hmm. The MAB is monoclonal. M is monoclonal, meaning it's a single antibody that only does one specific thing. It's not out causing trouble anywhere else. And then the AB is antibody. So these are going to specifically bind to something. It's an antibody that will go in and bind to a very specific peptide. And so it's just telling you that this is a product that is, again, focused, humanized, antibody.
And this has all come about because of our deeper and deeper understanding of how the immune system is reacting. And we can now develop, because of technology, antibodies that very specifically block one small protein in a chain of reactions. And we're getting benefits out of that. And I want to come back, if we get time, and talk about side effects of those things. Because
right.
In cancer, there have been some, we don't like these reactions, does it? But you're telling me, at least in an allergy, these seem to be working pretty safely.
Yeah, one of the things in cancer that makes it difficult is these are human cells that are impacted. So you've got to go in and you're going to impact that human cell. We're going in specifically and attacking a specific cell that's causing trouble. So we're not so much in a situation where we're having to kill good cells along the way. So I think that might be a distinction. I was going to make a note, too, with the biologic agents. Right now, there's about 8 very hopeful agents that are in the pipeline and not too far away, just for the management of some of these allergic disorders.
So you held up a sign that said thermoplasty, if I'm reading your writing. What is that?
Well, I wanted to also mention this. It's not a biologic agent, but there's a very important technique that's been developed. It uses what we call radio frequency. So the radio frequency, they put in a tube down into the lung, and they turn this machine on, and with high frequency, it opens an airway up, the airways that have closed tight. And it opens up that airway, and that airway stays open. Hmm. Now, this is done, I think, 12 segments at a time, and you have 3 different interventions, so 3 different times, and you're asleep when this is occurring, so this is done under anesthesia. But this is done for patients where really none of these biologics are working, so when you feel that there's nowhere left to go, there is somewhere left to go. And I'm very excited that it's just been in the last few months that this has now become available here at Providence Alaska Medical Center Dr. Martinovich is doing that. So we're very excited for that opportunity.
So as a consequence of this uncontrolled inflammation, sometimes due to allergy, sometimes due to not, there is thickening of the airway lining, and the airway lining gets narrower and narrower and narrower, so it's harder and harder to breathe. And this is a physical way to try to reopen those airways is what I'm hearing you say.
It is. Exactly. But this is really in the severe, and I would say end-stage asthma of that. I think that but it is definitely a progression in things that we're able to do. And it's not typically associated. We don't use that so much in that allergic asthma. You know, there's non-allergic asthma as well. There's asthma where we're dealing more with neutrophils. And we now see asthma that overlaps with, you know, chronic obstructive lung disease like COPD. Mm-hmm. We call that overlap syndrome or ACOS. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, when we're looking at that, we're looking at many different kind of subtypes of asthma, and if we can tease those out, we can really better focus on therapy. We didn't even talk about, you know, the muscarinic agents, but we could certainly address that if you want.
Well, we got about 2 minutes left. I got umpteen hundred emails.
No.
It's my. I just am sorry that some. But we just had to get this information out. So let's end with you. I'm going to have to apologize to people who've called and sent emails. We're just not going to get to those. I wanted to get this information out. So we've got a couple of minutes. What you know, like Louis Rukeyser used to say at the end of his Wall Street Week, what do we want people to take away from this program? I've developed that ending. So what do we want people to be hearing about allergy and these particular diseases?
What we've learned is that the earlier the intervention, the better the outcome. So I want to say that first. You know, I think really addressing it early on, we can really make a difference downstream. And hopefully reduce the likelihood of developing, you know, more severe problems down road. And secondly, I think is, you know, understanding that there are opportunities for therapies. You know, I know that sometimes it probably feels like this is just the way my life is going to be. Well, that's not necessarily true. We have a lot of advanced therapies that are available. It's not something that everyone, in fact, the majority don't need these therapies. But there's the minority of patients that can be life-changing. And I think another that would go well is looking at compliance. I mean, working or adherence. So when your medical provider is recommending therapy, try to stick with it. It's important. You know, the fact that you're not feeling bad today doesn't mean the asthma's not there. You know, you've got to really stick with your therapy because it's going to progress whether you feel it or not. You don't start feeling symptoms until you're down to 60% of pulmonary function. Well, you don't want to live at 65% and not have symptoms because that is going to progress into a point where we can't control symptoms at all. So I think early intervention, stick with your therapy, really, really stay that course, and, you know, do seek help if things are getting a bit out of hand.
You know, in medicine, we've, except for infectious diseases, the idea of cure has been very, very difficult when you really look at it. But it sounds to me like in cancer and in allergy, we're beginning to really give long-term tolerance, maybe is not exactly the right word, but better livability for some very debilitating diseases for some people. So thanks for taking the time and sharing that with us today, Jeff.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Thad.
It's been wonderful. So if you would like to continue this discussion on allergic disease, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org, where you also can find our archives, and you can let us know your thoughts and suggestions at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, Prentice Pemberton, our co-host, will be talking about adolescents, mental health, and technology. You can join him Monday, January 15th at 2 p.m. I want to thank Dave Waldron, who engineered today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.